Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Joan Steino Lester. Dr. Lester is an award-winning author and educator. She is a member of a biracial family. Her books are in wide use as college texts and corporate handbooks. Dr. Lester and I will be discussing her passion in writing about issues dealing with the intricacies of family, friends, and work dynamics among people of different races. Good morning, Dr. Lester. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I'm doing wonderfully well.
Wonderful. I really enjoyed reading Mama's Child. It is an excellent read. It's wonderfully written. It's intense, detailed, and really speaks to the heart. So congratulations for that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I am getting a wonderful response. It's been quite heartening in the almost 3 months since the book is out.
Well, I'm excited for you, and I'm excited to have you on the air with me this morning. So let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Oh, that's a long time. Let's see. I was born actually in North Carolina. My parents were very young college students at the time and an experimental college called Black Mountain College. And that was significant for me in that it was kind of the template for our family life because it was a progressive college where the students were quite empowered. It was a very small college. It was new, and the students helped build the buildings, I mean, physically,
wow,
with the faculty members. And it was very community-oriented, as if to say we're a community of learners here together. Mm-hmm. And it was a very democratically run institution. So that's kind of how my family worked. We had family meetings once a week where we got to vote on things and vote on trips that we would take, little weekend trips or how family chores were being divided up. And so that, I think, gave me a wonderful grounding in democracy. And I've pursued that ever since. Then race kind of came into the picture. Well, my family was fairly active. Well, we called it then anti-racism integration work at that time. And as it happened, when I was 21, I met and married an African-American man, and I am not African-American. I'm white, or so-called. All of these terms, I must preface by saying so-called, because as is more acknowledged these days, they're not biologically based at all. They're completely socially constructed terms. But in any case, and this was an era still of segregation, so it was rather a big deal. And we had two children. There was a lot of social pressure from every direction, as well as laws. It was still illegal in some states for us to be married until the Supreme Court decision of 1967 with Loving versus Virginia. And we had the children. Eventually, we broke up. And I became a writer. I did a lot of other things. I taught college for a while. I went and got a doctorate in multicultural education and did a lot of teaching of various kinds, always including sort of that lens of diversity. And then my love of life writing came to the fore. I had long wanted to be a writer, but I kind of didn't know how when I was in my 20s. You know, how do you begin this process? How do you pursue it? What do you write about? And as it happened, actually, my ex-husband was a writer, and I'm sure that was one of our many attractions. So I learned something about writing and publishing through being married to him and living with him, and I edited all of his work. But eventually, I came into my own and became a writer, and about 23 years ago, 25 years ago, I began publishing articles in newspapers and magazines about diversity issues, and they were all nonfiction. My fiction only began about 10 years ago. I sort of made the switch after publishing hundreds of articles and three nonfiction books, one of them a biography and one a self-help book and one on current events, sort of political history. Then I made the switch to fiction, which I am loving. And Mama's Child is my second novel. My first novel was called Black, White, Other, and that was a young adult novel. And this one is an adult novel, Mama's Child. And I'm in love with this book, and so fortunately are a lot of other people. Ebony Magazine named it an editor's pick of the month for May, the month it came out. And I'm getting emails every day, which is really exciting from readers. I love to hear from readers.
Yeah. Well, it is a beautifully written book. There's no question about it. It's very thorough, very detailed, and very surreal when you read it. So it really engages all your senses in so many ways. And, of course, it is a wonderful topic. It not only covers the social aspects of, I guess, in this case, as you had mentioned, the context of races. But most importantly, I think that people need to understand, and I think I'm very sure people do understand, that it is a wonderful family book.
Yes, it's a mother, thank you, it's a mother-daughter story, but within the context of a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's really a coming-of-age story for both the mother and the daughter, set in a very particular social context. It's set in the 60s and 70s and 80s primarily. Mm-hmm. Although the story goes up to the year 2005. And it's the time that it was a very intense era when it was a very exciting era. We, and I was among the young activists of the time who were, you know, making enormous social changes in that we were breaking down these barriers between the so-called races, you know, between ethnic groups, breaking them down legally and socially.
When you were growing up, when did you discover you enjoy or love writing?
Well, first I discovered reading. And the wonderful public library near our house, and I have to put in a word here of praise for public libraries, because so many writers throughout American history have discovered a love of reading and then later writing through public libraries. I mean, what a wonderful resource that we have that we really need to cherish. Well, my parents took me to the public library every Saturday, and I could pick two or three books. And I remember the Heidi story by Johanna Spyri. This was a novel about a girl in, I think, Switzerland. It took place in the Alps. And I just loved this book, and it was the first time, I was probably about eight, and it was the first time that I attached an author's name to a book and realized that a person wrote this book. Books didn't just appear, you know, the way as a young child, you know, objects appear, you don't really think about how they're created. But I realized that there was a person who wrote this book, and that just absolutely fascinated me. How did she think of this story that I loved so much? And that was a story beloved in many parts of the world for many decades. I mean, already by the time I read the book, it had been out for many, many decades. So I became an avid reader all through elementary and high school. And in college, I majored in English literature, as so many aspiring writers do, because mostly I just love to read. And I thought, I can't believe this. I get to go to college, read a lot of novels and poems and nonfiction books. I mean, it was wonderful. I devoured them. And I even liked writing the papers. Actually, that's probably when I discovered I had a love of writing. Well, no, in high school, I won an American Legion writing contest in high school, what I love about being an American or something like that. I won first prize, which was $25. So that was my first writing prize when I was about 14. And then in college, I did very well with my papers. I mean, the English professors really, really liked my papers where I analyzed various books. And so that's when I knew I loved writing, but I didn't have any idea what to do with it. You know, how do you just go out when I graduated from college at 21?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just had no idea. I remember, actually, it's sort of sad to me now, but I stood on a street corner in New York City at a payphone, and I called a publishing house. I don't know which one now, but I looked up in the phone book, a big publishing house, and I asked to speak to an editor. And for some reason, I was put through, and I said, I want to be an editor. And the person really just brushed me off, kind of, what's your experience? Well, I really didn't have experience. I just wanted to learn. And that didn't go anywhere. That was kind of my one burst of, you know, effort toward getting into publishing and writing. And then it was many years until, but I did keep a journal that I considered I was scribbling in, and that was a lengthy journal. It was too much for a mere, you know, book to hold. So I wrote on long yellow legal paper and just kept in folders my writings, because I wrote pages every day. And I only realized later, when I began to publish, that that had been my part of my training, probably editing my ex-husband's work was the other part, but writing in those journals. So I say to any of your listeners out there who are writing in journals, that's writing. So begin to claim yourself as a writer, and it may be that that's the form of writing that you'll continue to write, you know, to
very
work in fine, but that's writing. And that was really a training ground for me, because my journals became more elaborate in terms of using, consciously beginning to use images and create metaphors, so it wasn't just pouring out my feelings.
Do you use your writings to express yourself in a public forum in some ways, or just to entertain others?
I would say it's a combination. I'm not sure that I would use the word entertain, although I'm sure that many people are entertained, especially by my novels. Which people tell me, and the biggest comment I get is I couldn't put it down. I read half the night and went to work sleepy for two nights in a row until I finished it, or, you know, I even stopped work during the day and began to read and couldn't stop. So obviously, I guess you could call that people being entertained. I certainly write a lot. Well, let me even back up. Before it's expressing myself, I write a lot to figure out, to understand myself. And that's not unique among writers. I think many of us, part of what propels us into this solitary work, which may take years and years to complete a book as we work on it over and over, but it helps us understand ourselves. And then, yes, there's the joy of self-expression and the joy of the response from readers. This latest book, Mama's Child, which, as you said, is a family story and particularly a mother-daughter story, I've been quite fascinated by the response, because some people, the book is written, I should say, in two voices, the mother's and the daughter's voice, so chapters alternate. We get both of their perspectives, especially on their relationship, which becomes rather fraught during Ruby, the teenage girl's, the daughter's teenage years and into her 20s and 30s. And some readers respond very much to the mother character and some very much to the daughter character, and they actually get rather exercised about it. I've had readers say, email me and say, I just wanted to slap the mother. She wasn't listening to her daughter, I've had others say, that daughter was so annoying. And I actually got an email yesterday from a woman in her early 80s who said she was very triggered by the mother's story, actually triggered memories of her own mother. So although she was in her 80s, she was identifying more with the daughter in the book. So I have found that amazing. It's kind of like a Rorschach test for readers, you know, which character do you identify with most? And since everybody has a mother somewhere or a mother figure, and many of us are mothers, everybody has a way to hook into this book. Other readers have said, this is also interesting to me, they have compassion for both characters. They can see how much they love each other and how, in a sense, how circumstantial the misunderstandings are. And they see that it's a book of healing and forgiveness and transformation. It's really a book about love.
Well, very interesting. What is the inspiration behind Mama's Child? Because I know the style of writing that you use, going back and forth within the two characters, is quite astonishing. So can you tell us what inspired you to do it in accordance to that sort of format?
Well, I've always, part to me of appreciating diversity is hearing different voices in our culture and understanding that we're not a mono-voiced culture, although in media until fairly recently, we mostly heard only one voice in writing or on TV or radio, and that was the white male, middle-class voice. So I've always been interested in hearing stories from other people, too. What has their experience been like? And it's often very, very different. And part of creating a family story, I thought, would be really interesting to hear the different voices. The mother in the story is white, and the daughter is biracial, because the mother in this book, like myself, married an African-American man in the early 60s, and then they had several children. So I thought it would be really instructive to all of us, including to me, the writer, to hear what the different characters have to say. And I actually began the book only from the mother's perspective, partly because I thought, you know, there's so many books written by daughters about, you know, my rotten mother and how, you know, she was so crazy, she was so this, she was so that. We don't have very many, as many, nearly as many family stories from a mother's point of view, talking about her relationship with the children. That's somewhat verboten to do as a mother. But I began, so I began this book thinking, well, that would be an interesting perspective that we don't have a lot of in the culture. After I had written one draft, I honestly, I heard a voice. It was the voice of Ruby, the daughter, saying, "You white women, you're always putting out the white point of view only. I am going to have my point of view in here." And I began to type a furious chapter by Ruby, giving her point of view, saying, "I'm going to be in here too. You're not going to hog up all the space."
Very interesting. What make you choose the various characters in the book, though? I think they are very real, obviously, no question about that. The conversations are very detailed, and as well as the rest of the fill-ins, what I consider as background noise, are very detailed as well. What makes you choose these characters?
Well, certainly a biracial family was something I knew. You know, and there is a saying among writers, write what you know. There's also an understanding among writers that while we're, for fiction writers, while we're writing kind of in a landscape or an environment that we understand, we take these facts of our life and use them like a springboard, like a diving board, to dive into the deep waters of our imaginations. So, and I think this gets confusing for readers sometimes who know, yes, I had a biracial family and I had children and I was the white mother, so is this a book about us? No, it's actually fiction. It's not my family story, but I did understand what some of the tensions and, you know, the love of a mother and children and a wife and husband and, you know, among all the people, and the tensions especially of that era of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So once I began the book, I deliberately, actually consciously, started with the mother character to create a character who was very unlike me. I'm a small, I'm a quite petite woman. I weigh 108 pounds, 5'3". Well, this woman is what I've always kind of wanted to be, is a big strapping 5'10", 160 pounds. She has long red hair, kind of very dynamic out there. She has an Irish background, which I don't. She loves dogs, which I hate to say this in front of your listeners. I don't. They're fine. I don't hate dogs. I just don't want them in my house. But this woman is avid. She always has two dogs. And she's a very impulsive person. And while I have my impulsive moments, I'm really rather more organized. I tried to create a personality, a physical character, and then a temperamental character who is extremely different from me, so that I could really write the book as fiction. But that helped me to just begin to envision her, and then I envisioned all of the other characters as, you know, as themselves, which is really quite a fun project, to create characters.
Yeah.
Very godlike. You know, you create this world. It's fantastic. And then at the beginning, you're kind of, it's like puppets. You're making the characters do this and that.
Yeah.
You have an idea. But it's a very phenomenal and almost a spiritual process, in that the characters do begin to, as Ruby, the daughter, did speak to me, the characters begin to animate themselves almost. And I will write a scene and then read it over the next day and think, wow, I could have never written that. That's really good. I couldn't have thought of this twist in plot, that the character would do that. Oh, my goodness. So obviously it is flowing through me, but it's more than my conscious mind as the characters really take on life. And when I finally finished this book, which I worked on and off with another book in between, but for 10 or 11 years, I had sent in the final version to my editor at Simon & Schuster. I felt I missed the characters a lot. They had become so real for me. Yet, on the other hand, I never want to go back and read my own work once it's in print. I have read it hundreds, if not literally thousands of times while I've been working on it. So, yes, I do pick out sections that I read at bookstores or other venues. To listeners, and I enjoy that. But as far as sitting down, I don't miss the characters that much that I actually sit down and read my own work.
How much research did you do before you write the book, especially on issues of radical politics in the 60s and 70s, in both the civil rights movements as well as the wave of women's movement?
Well, I was participating in both of them, so obviously I had my own memories, but I did quite a bit of research, actually, to go back and make sure that I had the years right for, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the various kind of external things that happened. And I did read a number of books about the 60s and 70s to kind of remind myself of the flavor. And I had some of the early documents of the women's movement. The first few years we put out, actually they were like mimeographed pamphlets, and I saved those all these years, so I read all of those and did all I could to, you know, but it was research on the internet and through books. I ordered lots and lots of used books. I have a whole bookshelf now of books of the 60s and 70s. So that was fun. I like
that
part.
What was the most difficult thing for you to write?
Probably the character who is most like myself, the mother, despite the fact that I created her. And that was the most difficult at the beginning. Eventually, it wasn't, because she really did become her own person.
Yeah.
But that, at the beginning, that was the hardest thing, to create a character who had sort of my spot in the family and yet wasn't me.
How much of you is in the book?
Well, of course, a book, in a sense, everything that an author writes is completely themselves. It's sort of like your dreams. Mm-hmm. You may be dreaming about lots of other people, but you're the dreamer. So you've created this. So everything, in one sense, in the book is me. But then again, most of it may not be, which I know it sounds paradoxical, but it is coming from my imagination. One of the things that I find most interesting in writing fiction is the way that shards of my own experience find their way into the book, but yet in various characters. For instance, I won't give it away, but one character in the book dies and is in the hospital for a couple weeks before that character dies. And I based all of that hospital, well, it's several scenes, I based all of that on my father's death 10 years ago when he was in the hospital and I was with him for a few weeks. So everything that happened there is pretty much what happened to my father. But yet this is to a completely different character, different time, different place. But I just used both the sort of the facts of that, the way that the tubes were put into the body and the, you know, the rubber sheet underneath the person, the nurse coming and turning the person, all of that, the facts, but also the emotions, you know, my emotions as a daughter with my father who was dying. That's all in the book. And in my last book, also the novel Black, White, Other, which just came out 2 years ago, there's a lengthy scene there in which a 15-year-old girl runs away. And I used when I was maybe a little younger, 13 or so, I ran away just for a day. This girl in my book stays away over one night and has a rather hairy time in San Francisco overnight. But I came back at nightfall, but I used the emotion of that. You know, what drives a young person to run away? That's, you're just feeling like, oh, nobody loves me. Nobody understands me. You know, everything is so awful. I just can't stand it. You know, I'm going to run away as if that's going to make it better. You know, think if you'll go and you'll be with some other place. I used to think of setting out for an aunt who lived across country. But, of course, I never really made it past the bus station. But, you know, you just think your troubles will be solved if you get away from your horrible parents. And I used, you know, that long ago emotion of my own to fuel some of the energy for that scene. So many, many conversations I've had, little, it can just be a, you know, a line or a word, will make its way in just different ways into the book. And it, for me, that gives it the verisimilitude as I'm writing, and then I think for the reader, because I'm channeling that real emotion and, you know, perhaps some of the, you know, external events as well into a scene, moving my plot forward and my character development.
What would you like for the readers to gain in reading Mama's Child?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. These are all great questions, by the way. You're a wonderful interviewer, and you really give me space to think, and I appreciate that. For the readers to gain, I think compassion and understanding how transformative the power of love and forgiveness is, because that is, I don't want to give a spoiler alert here, but, you know, what ultimately occurs in Mama's Child. And I think in all of my books, because I really do write to inspire people and empower people, that kind of like, yeah, you can make it no matter what's going on. There are always ways to love yourself more and to love other people more and to find a way over. So this is a book about healing. And I also wanted to convey something about the 60s and 70s and 80s and that era. Because it's now considered historical fiction. I was amused when I actually got the book in print, and on the back, you know, there's a category for every book, and this is called historical fiction. I thought, oh, that's funny, you know, since I had lived through it. But I wanted to give readers who didn't live through it, and better understanding of the power of that time and how much the activists of that era were motivated by love and idealism, mm-hmm. as the characters in this family, the parents, really are. So that was actually a big impetus. I very much wanted to set it in that time. I mean, the characters' lives are inextricably woven into their setting, which
right.
is a very particular period in American history from which we're still feeling the ripples
right.
of all the
right.
desegregation efforts that are still going on. I mean, we're mm-hmm. not finished with the work that we began 50 years ago.
One of the things that I got from reading the book, there are two major words that, well, one of them you had mentioned just now, love, and the other word is fear. And if you look at it in our lives, those are the two separate but equal forces that govern everything that we do, love and fear. It's how we present ourselves, and it's a balancing equation, because too much love is not good, too much fear is not good. It's a balancing act. And so I think that's the prevailing energy that ultimately flows, because that is real. That's how we lived our life 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 50 years ago, and that's how we're going to live our life today and tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's beautiful. That is very much the story of Mama's Child, as these characters are navigating between those two poles of love
right.
and fear.
Yeah, yeah. And I certainly hope your book will shed a lot of light in terms of connecting people together. Let me answer this. How will your book help bring a better understanding about the plight of biracial children?
Thank you. I forgot all about that. That was a very big part of the motivating force for my writing this book and my own energy, since my now adult children are biracial, and I know lots and lots and lots of young biracial people, and that that demographic is just growing exponentially.
Right.
Yet there's still the probing by other people who meet biracial people, who say, "What are you?" That really mm-hmm. difficult and intrusive question. What are you?
Well, yeah.
What are you talking about? I'm a human being. No, I mean, what are you? And then ultimately, where are you from? Like, you're from some other planet or some other continent, or because we're such a highly racialized culture, it's still very unnerving to many people if they can't pigeonhole someone mm-hmm. they meet into a so-called racial or ethnic box.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
are you? What is your ethnicity? I need to know that. It's kind of like we need to know somebody's gender, and when that's ambiguous, you know, that's unnerving
yeah.
too. How am I supposed to react to you? As if we're supposed to react so different to people who are either different genders or different ethnicities and mm-hmm. from different backgrounds. So, and that is certainly something that Ruby and her brother Che are dealing with in the book, although Che handles it pretty effortlessly. He's such an easygoing guy. But mm-hmm. Ruby, who's so intense and so politically charged and aware, as her parents are, I mean, in a sense, she's really her parents' child, more than her brother is, because they're so keenly aware of race, even as they're trying to deconstruct and demolish the racial barriers. They're highly racially aware. So I wanted to help people who may not be biracial understand what some of the dilemmas are and, you know, see how some people navigate their way through it. And also, I wanted it to be a book for biracial people. And I have, I've gotten a lot of emails from biracial people. I would say, actually, it's been really interesting to me. Most of my, certainly not all by any means, but much of the reader response, and I'm getting, several emails a day. I would say the majority of it is from people of color. Who are just really appreciative of this kind of very intimate look at a family talking and dealing very openly with racial, different racial dilemmas that are playing out inside the family as well as outside. One in 10 marriages today is interracial in the United States.
And again, when we talk about race here, I mean, I know the book reflects on the black and white issue, but race, with the situation in Florida, for example, I mean, when you have someone who's been identified as a white Hispanic, that's a new term that was coined for the sake of making it a legitimate issue. And so when you look at those kind of issues, it's like, okay, we are actually creating something out of nothing just to prove a point or to start a debate and discussion in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, the census, I have to say, has for a long time used the phrase white Hispanic and black Hispanic. And well, is it, but it, as you're saying, it's just crazy the way we're trying to dice and slice and people.
Yeah.
And I guess that's when I first began, once I had children, to realize, you know, in my gut how nonsensical the concept of race was, because here are my own children. What so-called race are they? They came out of my body. And they're, you know, identifiably dark skin, you know, not terribly dark, but they're identifiable as people of color. So what is this? We have a huge range of both skin tones, hair texture, all the so-called attributes and characteristics that scientists used in the 18th century to create the concept of races. Coincidentally, at the very same time, they were creating human slaves, you know, like you really needed to be able to categorize some people as so different, or, you know, bringing in Chinese Americans to dig and, you know, do heavy labor on railroads and, you know, wanting to keep people separate and segmented in order to basically exploit their labor.
But race is an issue that is actually worldwide, though. I mean, to give you an example would be like from my situation. I'm Chinese, but I was born in Malaysia. And within my culture, within the Chinese in Malaysia, for example, that's why I sort of relate to your book very well, in the sense that I'm what they call so-called straight-born Chinese. And the best way to explain that to you would be, have you heard of the Cajuns in Louisiana?
Right.
So somewhere along the line in the lineage, you have the French, European, I guess, Anglo-Saxon, that had intermarried with the Southerners. And so you have this, what we call Creole or Cajun people.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my situation, we have the straight-born Chinese, where somewhere along the line, who you're talking about 200-300 years ago, where the Chinese that had came over during those time had intermarried with the locals, but yet still kept up with all the Chinese traditions. But however, this is an interesting part, but most of these Chinese don't speak Chinese.
right. So, I know someone else who has that similar heritage.
Yeah. When we talk about race, you're an advocate of understanding race and so forth, which is wonderful, wonderful work that you do. But at the same time, there is a situation here also, I believe, that as we go through the generations, the interesting part about it is that you got the older generation and the newer generation, and of course your book talks about bridging the generation gap in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, society in itself, in some ways I believe, will take care of it, in the sense that as the older generation passes on, the newer generations don't look at those issues anymore.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful? It's very much the world that we've been wanting to create. It's wonderful, the younger generations.
But it's a process of evolution, social evolution.
Yes. Well, and I write books to help the process along, because we do evolve, but I think partly we evolve consciously.
Right.
And the more, you know, you do things like your radio show, I do things like writing my books. I mean, we're trying to help move it along in the direction that we would like to see it go, because it's not always inevitable. I mean, thus fascism and, you know, other kind of oppressive systems. So it's great that we can, you know, keep moving along, helping encourage more inclusive cultures, which is taking place anyway.
And I feel that in the end, what will happen, let me put it this way. For one thing, there will always be thoughts of better or worse whenever you see someone that's different than you. Now, to be classified as a racist, that's a very heavy, heavy word to use at the same time. But then it's being used sometimes at inappropriate times. So it's sort of like almost a death sentence in some ways. But I find that a lot of times, if one discriminates against the other, it's usually about intelligence because of the fear. When you lack certain knowledge, the fear side of the equation of our balance kicks in.
Yeah, lacking the knowledge, which is, again, one reason that we create the media, you and I, is that we do, trying to give more knowledge.
So,
right?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Coming back to the question that you addressed earlier, which is quite interesting, when someone asks you, what are you, how should someone answer that question?
I think it depends on the context and their mood. You know, how appropriate is that question? In Mama's Child, I have Ruby is sitting on an airplane at one point when somebody asks her, you know, what are you? A guy that she's just gotten into conversation with. And, you know, that's kind of inappropriate at that moment. She doesn't really know him. I mean, it's a very personal question. So I think in that situation, she could be, you know, excused if she politely tries to brush him off. You know, like, what are you talking about? And what are you? You know, can put it back that way. Or you can say, or you can just ask the question again, what do you mean? And then the person, because they're kind of flummoxed to have a question put back, may say, well, they may just repeat it, what are you? And you can say again, well, what are you talking about? I mean, I think it depends how sincere the listener, the questioner is. I mean, you can give the information, well, just as you told me, you know, I'm my lineage is a straight-born Chinese, you know, person in Malaysia, and that's my heritage, and, you know, you can give some information, which can be historically and culturally very interesting, if you feel like it, but I don't think, you're not bound, you're not like a walking, you know, educational museum. I really think it depends on the context and what you feel like doing. And so a whole range of responses, I think, would be appropriate.
How about you yourself personally? How do you address that issue when someone brings it up? Certainly not about you, but as they meet your family.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I would probably give a fairly straight answer.
Yeah.
Because my grandchildren, I have three grandchildren,
and
one of them is much darker skinned than the other two. And so he's the one, because my son married a white woman. And so that African-American heritage, you know, is showing more strongly in one of the grandchildren than the other two. And so people definitely ask his mother when she's out with him, or may ask me, you know, and I would just say in a, you know, casual way, he's African-American, his father's biracial, you know, my son is biracial. You know, just sort of treat it casually and straight up, most likely. I mean, depending on how we're asked, but it, mostly it would be if you're in a conversation with somebody. But I think it's easier for me, partly because it's not about myself, and I'm not like a vulnerable 14-year-old. You know, when you're a teenager, and you're just already, you're like, who am I, and how do I appear to the world, and oh my gosh, I've got a tiny, tiny, tiny pimple on my cheek. I can't go out of the house for a week because everybody will hate me and laugh at me.
Right.
You know, so then to have that kind of scrutiny is much more challenging, say, than it would be for me.
Well, that's true. Well, we all go through the process of when you're talking about when you're 13, 14, or 15 for that matter, you are coming into that age where we know it all, even though
there
we're looking.
There is that aspect, but true. My granddaughter's coming into that age. She knows everything.
That's correct. That's
She's
correct.
Actually told us that she could drive our car, no doubt. Would we please let her? She said she knows she could do it.
Yeah, probably better, too. That's the whole idea.
<Right.
laughs> So on one side of the equation, you have this drive, this tremendous amount of passion, even though you're on the verge of self-discovery, but yet you felt like you know everything. And then, of course, you go through the cycle of knowing that somewhere along the line, as you get older and as you flavor the university of life, so to speak, you realize that you may not know it all. And then when you get to a certain age, you realize that you don't know squat. You don't know anything.
Right. I'm approaching that age.
And so, yeah, you know, you go through the cycle. And what I like about your book, in some ways, the process of love and fear, the self-discovery, forgiveness, those kind of things go through the full cycle. And as one goes to a coming of age, coming the full cycle, then you have this revelation and you finally realize what life is all about and what unconditional love is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Ruby certainly, we see it both with Ruby and Elizabeth, her mother, in Mama's Child. But we get to see Ruby from the time she's 11 until her 39th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she begins to realize a lot that she doesn't know, hasn't understood about her mother.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, you can go to Amazon.com to buy the book, or BarnesandNoble.com, or you know, any of the online booksellers, and certainly lots of bookstores do carry it. Although it's interesting, the Barnes and Noble, actually the stores themselves, have been boycotting Simon and Schuster books for the last few months. They're having some kind of dispute.
Yeah.
I don't even know all of what it's about, but so it might not be at Barnes & Noble's. I mentioned that because all my other books always sold well at Barnes & Noble's. But I think most independent bookstores, many of them are carrying it, and if they're not, you can always ask them to order it or go online.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a website, JoanLester.com. So it's just www.JoanLester, one word, JoanLester, my first and last name, www.JoanLester.com. And that tells about events, where I'm going to be. I'm doing quite a lot of promotion and touring for Mama's Child, so you can look on the website to see if I'll be at a bookstore in a city near you. I live on the East Coast. On the West Coast, but I'm going to the East Coast this fall. Again, I did a little bit in June, but I'm going back to New York and D.C., so I have an events page on my website.
Fantastic. Wonderful. How has writing about race and relationships impacted you personally?
How's it impacted me personally? I think I've become more compassionate myself through writing about this family. And my previous book, which was about another biracial girl, Black, White, Other, was about a girl named Nina Armstrong. And so I've spent really the last 12 years writing these two books. And I think it's made me more compassionate toward not only biracial people and the dilemmas that they face, as well as the gifts that they have, because, you know, our president, President Obama, is biracial. And I think part of the gifts that we see that he has of an ability to work with such a variety of people comes from being biracial, because you've navigated, and certainly many immigrants might have this as well. If you're used to navigating several cultures, you develop a skill at that. So I think I've seen that more clearly as I've really focused my own attention there. Writing about relationships, how has that affected me personally? I think writing from the two points of view was very helpful to me as well. Not only was I sort of putting my beliefs in practice, but I got to see that in this family, you know, you can't really blame anybody for the difficulties that all the family members had in relationship to each other, because everybody was really trying their best, but sometimes their best wasn't quite good enough. I think I've gotten more compassion for the challenges that everybody faces in relationships, and how helpful it is to be able, however we can do it in life, to see another person's point of view and understand, as we say, where they're coming from. And we can see how they may see a situation really quite differently. And blame is just such a useless emotion. It's just not going to get us anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very
so
true.
I think that's been it's something I've probably been developing these ideas and feelings anyway, but writing about them and sort of putting them on the page has helped deepen my own understandings.
So in short, you're telling your grandchildren that you're a better grandmother than you are a mother.
I think that's probably true. It probably is quite true. Hopefully, through all these years of living, we develop greater understanding. Isn't that kind of what it's all about? Why are we here? To develop ourselves spiritually, emotionally, you know, in our understanding for other people. Yeah, I probably am a better grandmother. Well, it's a lot easier job. But it's not, it's just lacking all that intensity of day-to-day life.
Right. See, if I can't stand you anymore, go home.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, absence makes the heart grow fonder. No, I always adored my own kids, but I mean, it's just such a different life when you're living in the household with people day to day than, you know, when you're just seeing them occasionally and you get to do nothing but dote. I can kind of just roll my eyes inside myself when there's things going on in that family that I don't necessarily think, well, that's not how I would do it. But it's strange being a grandparent because you really don't have any say over what's happening in that family, at least in the modern American family, the modern American nuclear family.
Very interesting. In your travels, and in addressing issues about race, what's your take on, say, projecting it within the next 5, 10, 15 years? What do you think it's going to look like?
Well, despite all the difficulties that have been we're all too aware of, especially recently with these highly publicized murders, I do think things are getting better. I think there's much more general awareness about race. I mean, we have a whole middle class of people of color in business and government and media that we didn't have a generation or two ago. I mean, it just wasn't there. It's hard to remember how solid the wall was.
Yeah.
So I think just the, you know, in the way that you're thinking, well, just as there are more biracial people and the younger generation is coming up, I think that things are definitely getting better. And I think having, you know, cracking the white male president, you know, whatever that was, reign and blockade, you know, I think that's been really significant. Obviously, it didn't usher us into a post-racial era, but it's moving us along the road where we get to see it. And then as we have people of other ethnicities and gender in government and, you know, at the highest levels, and in business and on media, I think it's normalizing people in every role. It was like when we first had what we called women doctors, you know, and we had to say that, a woman lawyer, a woman doctor, as if, you know, the norm was male. If you didn't say woman doctor, it was a male doctor. That was the norm. Or a woman lawyer, a woman something, you know, the norm is just male. But I think in all of these arenas, you know, we're really evolving actually pretty fast, although it may not always feel fast to the people involved.
Yeah.
But when we try to step back and take the long view.
Very interesting. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Do what you love to do. That's the main thing. Follow your passion. Don't put it off and think that you have to be tied to a life that, you know, you're really not enjoying. The more that you can enjoy your life and every moment in it, you know, sort of the better works you'll be able to do, and you'll enjoy your life more, and other people will more enjoy being around you. I guess that would be my recipe.
Wonderful. Basically, participate fully.
Yes, and joyfully.
Mm-hmm.
Participate
mm-hmm.
and be joyful in it. And if you're not being joyful, take a look at, you know, what's stopping you and tweak whatever you need to tweak so that you can get into that joyful space.
Wonderful. What's next for you?
I'm actually under contract for a book that's a sequel to Black, White, Other, and
mm-hmm.
it's called, at the moment, Langston Hughes and the One True Me.
Mm-hmm.
That's another young adult novel with some of the same characters that were in Black, White, Other. And that should be out in February 2015. So I'm busily revising it right now.
Fantastic. If you could share one important suggestion to new writers to fine-tune their craft, what would it be?
Revise, revise, revise. Don't expect that your first draft or your second draft is going to come out great, because if you expect that, you're
yeah.
going to be totally discouraged. Nobody's first draft comes out beautifully. That's just sort of laying down the track so you kind of see a little bit of the mass of what you may want to write about. I think of first drafts as like creating the clay
mm-hmm.
out of which you're going to sculpt your work. So just keep at it. Revise, revise. Read wonderful literature. Read good writing, because
mm-hmm.
that can really teach you and inspire you. And then
Fantastic.
Go back and revise some more.
Wonderful. Thank you. Dr. Lester, thank you for the great recipe for living you shared with us just now and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, please be with us next week. My guest will be David Burnham. He is an award-winning author and journalist. David's latest book, Any Road Will Take You There, A Journey of Fathers and Sons, chronicles a heartwarming road trip of discovery on generational bonds of fathers and sons. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Dr. Lester, thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.